Hi, and welcome to the Digital Enhanced Learning Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Rowell, and I work at London South Bank University as an academic developer. This series explores all things to do with learning, technology, and social media. Okay, great. Right, hi Chrissy. Hi Margie. How are you doing?
Hi Chris. Hi.
All right, good.
I'm speaking for both of us.
All right, good. Okay, I'll have to ask you to come in one at a time. So Margie, where are you calling from?
I'm calling in from Victoria, British Columbia, Canada, on the west coast of North America.
Okay, I'm going to be very British now and ask you what the weather's like over there at the moment.
It's gorgeous. It's going to be about 25 degrees here today, but there is a cool ocean breeze if it gets too stuffy. It's fantastic.
Okay, it's quite hot here as well, but we don't have that ocean breeze in the Elephant and Castle in South London, I'm afraid. And Chrissy, where are you calling from?
Hi, yes, I'm in Glossop in Derbyshire in the Peak District in the northwest of England.
Okay, a beautiful part of the country. Okay, right, so those are the sort of introductions. Really, I just want to get into the questions now. So first of all, just as a little bit of background, first of all, you, Chrissy, can I just ask you what your job title is and what you actually do in your job?
Where I'm doing my job.
Sorry, no, what you do in your job. It might be apparent from your job title, but if I mention my job title, people's sort of eyes glaze over and they don't exactly know what I do. So what's your job title and what's the type of things you do in your post?
Okay, I'm a principal lecturer in academic CPD, or more simply an academic developer, in the Center for Excellence in Learning and Teaching at Manchester Metropolitan University. And what that means is I work mainly with academic staff and other professionals who teach or support learning at the university, so not exclusively colleagues who are on academic contracts, on enhancing their teaching practice, scholarly activities around teaching, but also their professional development and curriculum design, redesign, etc.
So you're very staff-facing as opposed to student-facing, is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
But I also like, and I do work with academics, with colleagues, and do some teaching on specific courses.
Okay, brilliant. And Margie, what about yourself?
Well, I'm retired, but when I was working as a full-time academic, I was a librarian at Mount Royal University in Calgary, Alberta. And I worked in information literacy instruction, so teaching students how to find things, how to understand what they were finding, and how to use what they were finding ethically, responsibly, and accurately. I also had a faculty or a teaching staff focused role in working with Scholarship of Teaching and Learning, working in our Institute for Scholarship of Teaching and Learning, and working individually with faculty on research projects.
Okay, brilliant. Okay, good. I think that sets the context a little bit. Before you met on social media, and it appears from your article, which I've read, that you have a shared interest in, and hopefully I can pronounce this correctly, phenomenography. Is that correct? Yep, good. To be honest, I think I'd heard of this term, and when I first saw the title, I read it as phenomenology, but it's quite different, isn't it, I think, what you're talking about. So can you explain, either one of you or both of you, what this term means simply? Is that possible?
I'll let Chrissy go first.
All right, okay, thanks. Chrissy?
I should go. Okay, I wasn't prepared for that. I could have brought some Lego bits, but this is what I did in my Viva to explain the methodology. But basically what it is, it's a methodology for qualitative research, which is used to explore the variations of experiences, of the lived experiences. And it has been developed for higher education to actually enhance learning and teaching. So this is what brought us together. Yes, a methodology, which might sound strange that a methodology can connect people, but that's actually what happened.
Okay, so it's a qualitative research method and based on people's interpretations of things, is that... I need to put things fairly simply. Does that make sense?
Margie, do you want to respond?
Well, it's based on their experiences of particular phenomenon. So there is the researchers, somewhat of the researchers' interpretations of those experiences. But it's the reason I like it is because it admits of variation, but it gives patterns of experience. Okay. So there are ways in which students experience academic text. There are ways within that in which a student might experience a particular part of academic text at a particular time and the connections that they might make to it. I like it because it doesn't categorize the student. It categorizes the experience. And so one student isn't necessarily this kind of reader or that kind of reader. They read this way and that way at different times.
So does that mean that they could have different interpretations
yep.
of the same text or whatever they're looking
they
at?
Yep.
Yeah, okay.
Yes.
All
and
right.
if we think about it, maybe we could add here deep surface and strategic learning are sort of on that spectrum. This is a study that was based on phenomenography. And
okay.
that's very well known and widely used.
Okay. So you both had this shared interest, and based on your sort of work, working lives, your research side of things, that existed before you met, and you actually met on Twitter, is that correct? Okay, how did that actually happen then? How did you meet up on Twitter? Can one of you describe that?
Well, I saw a post that a third person who's interested in phenomenography had posted on Chrissy's behalf to an account and added in an account that I managed for a journal of teaching and learning. And that was basically a call for help about phenomenography. It's not an easy method to get to know. Like many qualitative methods, it has its quirks. And so I felt a deep empathy, having had my own struggles with the methodology, and said, can I help? And the first thing I did was very librarianish. I sent references to studies using phenomenography. So,
okay, you sent those references to the third party or to Chrissy?
To Chrissy, because she was added in the original request.
Okay. And so was that useful, Chrissy, straight away?
That was really useful because I suddenly felt that I was not on my own anymore. I mean, it was a big relief knowing that somebody out there who I didn't even know was genuinely trying to help and did help. At the moment, I had completed the analysis and was looking for help on creating the final output of a phenomenographic study, which is the outcome space, a visualization basically of the findings.
Okay. And out of that, after you'd sent those references, did a sort of dialogue then happen between the two of you?
Yeah, for sure. There were many, many DMs on Twitter.
Oh, really?
And forth, back and forth. Oh, yeah.
So, again, can you describe that? I know it's probably obvious to you two, but what was it, question and answer type thing or what?
When Margie started sharing, because I asked specifically on seeing some examples of outcome spaces, because, I mean, it sounds nice to make a picture of...
Hang on, Chris, what outcome spaces?
I mentioned earlier that outcome space is final product, output of a phenomenographic study, which is a visualization of the categories of description. This is the term that's used in phenomenography, and shows their logical relationships with each other, basically. So while this sounds quite simple, actually to do it with the findings one gets, I found quite difficult. So after Margie sent me some examples, also some of her work that she was involved, I felt that I needed to talk with somebody through, even asynchronously. And it's interesting that we, for a long time, talked asynchronously, isn't it, Margie?
Yeah.
But that seemed to work because I had specific questions, and I think that the asynchronous dialogue gave us that opportunity, I think, to reflect on the answers and articulate questions and answers more fully than being spontaneously asked question randomly, where we didn't have time to respond, I suspect.
Okay. So yeah. That was really going to be my next question, is why was this dialogue important to you? I can see now that you were kind of, you're reading this research methodology. I presume doing that more or less on your own, I guess, in that context where you were. Even though you work in the university, not many other people were using this particular research method. And you managed to actually, through Twitter, meet somebody who had similar experiences, and you could sort of, I don't know, ask the more sort of detailed questions to somebody who actually could maybe give you some answers, or at least suggest some.
Yes, I mean, what I do need to add perhaps here is for context is that I was working on my own on the study, and it was a doctoral study. And I was under the impression that I shouldn't be sharing, the process of analysis with anybody. And when I finally had the findings, I felt, oh, I can breathe now. I can connect with somebody to discuss. And I really felt the need to share what I had found and discuss to get that peer dialogue going, which I didn't have until that point.
Okay. All right. So, Chrissy, I can see the obvious benefits for you. But Margie, what I mean, it's very altruistic of you to engage in such a dialogue. I mean, did you get anything out of it, or did you?
Oh,
I don't
absolutely.
know. Right.
Absolutely. For one thing, Chrissy had done much deeper study into phenomenography as a methodology than I had. I had done it more as a practitioner and not within the constraints and the time of doctoral research. And so it sharpened my understanding in dialogue with Chrissy, my understanding of phenomenography, and advanced it because phenomenography has evolved over the years. And I had done, I don't know, second stage phenomenography, and there's now more recent adaptations of the research. I would also say that phenomenography isn't that well known. It was so nice for me to talk to somebody who could use the experience that I had built up, because there weren't that many people at the time at my institution who were using it. And so being able to share, I'm a fairly senior academic. I've been around for a while, and so being able to help other people in the process at different stages in the process is kind of why I exist to a large extent.
Right. Okay. Good. I can see that. Eventually, then, so you were having these online dialogues, question and answer sessions, etc. And I could see why you both got something out of that. Why did you then went to meet up via Skype? Is that correct? And why did you feel like you wanted to move from an asynchronous mode to a more synchronous mode of communication? Sorry, I don't know who wants to go first on that one.
For me, partly it was curiosity. I knew so much about Chrissy and had seen how she thought and how she worked, both by following her on Twitter and seeing all the various conversations that she was involved in, and also having read bits and pieces of her thesis work and watching that evolve, that I was really curious. I wanted to meet more fully this person online, and because we'd also evolved our friendship by that point as well, and talked not just about the work, but about families and travels and other things. And so part of it was curiosity. Part of it was in working through some of the bits and pieces. Sometimes that synchronous dialogue can fire off questions. It's that bouncing ideas process. And asynchronous can work for that, especially if people are doing research or reading through documents on the side in the background. But if you're having one of those moments where it's flowing, what you really need is somebody there in the moment,
Right.
right? To talk through and say, what about this? What about this? What about this? And it sparks different ideas. Is that for you, Chrissy?
You want me to respond to that?
Yeah, Chrissy, if you've got anything to
I
add there.
mean, for me, it was important at some point to see Margie, and for me, it is Margie, to see
Doesn't
Margie
matter.
so that it's not just a person who I know through written messages or written communication, but I actually wanted to see the human being, because I think that what cements relationship. And I think because we have that opportunity now to connect like we do now, see each other's environment, I think, and my research shows that as well, that it can make a huge difference in how we feel about each other, how these connections develop and evolve. And I'm pleased we did that, yes.
Okay, all right, good. My next question is maybe a little bit tangential, but do you think the types of personalities that you both are that has affected the way or has played a part in the way that you communicated, especially in the online environment? Again, Margie, can I start with you first?
Sure. I think absolutely. I think personality type, there's a whole range of factors, but we're both clearly by view of our professions, we're both interested in helping other people and in reaching out and in dialogue. And I think that's common to us. I think our mums were from the same school, right? If you don't use your knowledge to help other people, you're not using your knowledge. You might as well not have it. And so I think we're both by professional and personal inclination, the kind to reach out and help, and who are interested in this kind of engagement and dialogue.
Okay. Chrissy, you
Yeah,
got anything?
I would agree with that. And it's interesting because they say you attract people who are like you, or there's like a magnet that automatically you find each other. And it seems to be the case. But what this doesn't mean is, I think, that we are the same or similar. I think we also complement each other. We are quite different, I would say, and it would be interesting to see Margie and to have you in the same room, to see. I mean, that would be
Have you
quite
not?
fascinating as
All
well. We
right.
have never met. We
You
have
never
never
met
met.
in person. All right.
No,
All
no, we
right.
have
That's
never met. We
by
have
proxy through Eric. We met.
yes, through a colleague of yours.
Oh,
Yes, I've
really?
met former Margie's colleague, but I have never met Margie. And it is actually now we were talking. That's the second time I see Margie online synchronously.
Wow.
So
Yeah.
the love of helping others, I suspect, is what was the binding glue. And I'm extremely grateful, that Margie did respond and this developed into something that's more than a call for help.
Okay.
Because she has become a really valuable and dear friend. And that's thanks to, I guess, how we approach the relationship and how it developed slowly, I would say, over time.
Okay, great. Which brings me on to there's a little quote that you reference a very recent piece of research done by Jordan and Weller at the end of your article. And that's based on a study. I think it's nearly 200 participants. But in that study, it just says 6.3% of academics were using social media to help others. I mean, why? I mean, given your experience, why do you think that figure is so low? I mean, academics use Twitter or use social media for lots of reasons, for networking, for meeting up with people across boundaries, across disciplines, all sorts of things. But actually, that study's indicating actually that what you're doing is really quite uncommon. Do you think there are your exceptions, or do you think there are barriers in the world of social media that stop that sort of thing happening?
I think there's a couple of things going on. I think there are some barriers, and I think there are barriers not just in social media, but in higher education culture, some cultures that value competitiveness over collaboration and that sort of thing. The study in question was based on researchers in the publisher's mailing list for Thomson ISI, Palgrave, and Nature Publishing Group. So it may be, the difference may also be a bit of a nature of the sample issue in that research. I'm part of a number of very, very generous communities on Facebook. Librarians on Facebook and Twitter share things all the time.
That's true, yeah.
Scholarship, it's what we do. And scholarship of teaching and learning as well, although it's a less active community by and large, tends to be a more collaborative, searching for partnerships, sharing information type of group. So I think there are psychographics within the demographics of that study. That said, I think we're looking at academic culture as well.
Right.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I would agree. And I don't think we are an exception. I mean, there are loads of people helping other people. And I suspect that loads of these helping activities, if you like, happen in the open, but not sort of in the open that we can all see it. And if I look at Catherine Cronin's work, who has these levels of openness, perhaps, I would position ourselves perhaps initially at the macro level, where it's global and it's really open and transparent. Anybody can see, and anybody could see the call for help and the initial sort of responses we had in the open. But we then moved that into a more private space. So I suspect that there will be other people who do reach out in more local communities, or closer, yes, closer communities where they do help each other. And perhaps there's also something else, and I haven't thought about it very much, but I think there's something about being seen as an expert and not wanting perhaps or feeling that it's the right thing to ask for help really openly. I don't know, this is just a question that I have, if that has actually an impact in the way people use to ask to seek help.
Right.
You know, is it really at the macro level, or does it go in the meso or micro level perhaps, or the nano level, like Catherine Cronin's work has shown?
Okay, yeah, no, I think that's true as well. Okay, that's been a really fascinating little interview. Is there anything either one of you'd like to add about your experiences of meeting up, sharing your own experiences between the two of you? Anything else that I've missed you want to add?
I'd just like to emphasize how much I've gotten out of it, and that partly to encourage other people to respond to when you see a flag up on Twitter saying, does anybody know, or does anybody have, or can anybody point me to. The Research Companion is a site that does this all the time on Facebook. There are ways of being it, and it's extraordinarily rewarding, both intellectually, because it stimulated my thinking, but also socially. I met a great friend.
Okay.
And I've had wonderful opportunities because of it.
Thank you. Yes, and I met a wonderful friend as well. And I mean, we continue collaborating and sharing work, and who knows what will come next.
Okay, well, you're going to have to meet up at some point, face to face.
I think we do have to. That would be lovely. Can I ask you, Chris, a question?
Yeah, sure, yeah.
Yes, when you read our contribution, what did you think about it?
In terms of, it was almost like reading a, I know this sounds a bit over the top, it was like reading a development of a relationship. So I know you had this sort of common interest, but it kind of moved from sort of quite early tentative stages to something more solid and something a bit more meaningful. So that was, it was very different from the other chapters, because it felt like, oh, this was more personable. Yeah, this is about human beings. It wasn't just about a product or a thing or something like that. And I think that's what made it such a nice little chapter, actually.
Thank you very much. It's lovely that you picked that up, because for me, the power of the technology is that it creates opportunities for human relationships to actually grow and flourish.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I think that's often forgotten.
Yeah.
And we get sort of... I don't know how to say that now. We get sort of focused more on the technology itself and the products of technology, while forgetting actually the process and the role it plays in human relationships.
Yeah, we do. We do forget that sometimes, I've got to admit. And I do as well. But as I say, I think you've brought it back to the heart of what we're talking about. So thank you for that. Okay, thank you. I'll stop there. And well, again, likewise, hope to see you both
yes.
sometime. Okay, take care. See you later.
Thank you very much.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dellcast. If you want to contact me about anything in this podcast, you can do so at Chris Rowell on Twitter, or email me at chris.rowell@hotmail.co.uk. Music was provided under a Creative Commons license from Bensound at bensound.com.